Whether you dig and plant in your backdoor garden or travel to Africa to come face to face with the pride of lions, you may be part of a growing movement. As James William Gibson sees it, a cultural sea change is underway, a re-enchantment with the natural world and the urge to protect it, instead of exploit it as a mere resource. Gibson writes about the movement in his book called A Re-Enchanted World, The Quest for a New Kinship with Nature. He told Anne Strange Champs about an environmentalist who united a community around a single tree.
A few years ago, a local environmental activist and artist named John Quigley did a tree sit in a large oak tree just north of the city of Los Angeles, still in Los Angeles County. And the reason John Quigley was sitting in this tree was because it was scheduled to be moved to make way for another massive suburban development in the area. The large, called New All Ranch, would be scheduled for something like 25,000 homes, 50,000 residents. And Quigley sat in the tree for roughly a month in a way to try to draw attention to what has happened in Southern California. We are the ground zero of suburban sprawl, and it has taken virtually all of our open spaces. It has taken most of our rivers and waterways and left us with a very monotonous repetition of housing developments and shopping centers over and over and over again.
In your eyes, something more is going on here than just a protest about a tree or even about a particular landscape.
Well, I think people are looking for a sense of transcendence. They are looking to reconnect to our world, our natural world, in a way that we've lost. It's just not enough to have consumerism. It just doesn't satisfy certain needs for life having meaning. Instead, we need that connection. The tree is like a portal to a larger world in saying, we need those animals, we need these places, we need these other creatures for our lives to be meaningful.
The word you use for this is enchantment or re-enchantment. The title of your book is A Re-Enchanted World. That's a really powerful word, enchantment. What do you mean by it?
Well, let's go back and talk about disenchantment. There's a very famous sociologist by the name of Max Weber. And in the 20s, Weber described the modernization process as the disenchantment of the world and its transformation into a causal mechanism. And by that, he meant that he implied that in the old kind of pre-modern world, people saw places as alive in various ways. And animals as connected to spirits and geographical places as having guardians of one kind or another. And so disenchantment stripped those levels of meaning away from the world and sort of just left it as a bunch of inert resources for human use. So, what do I mean by re-enchantment? I think that process is changing. In the 20th century, and particularly in the last 35 years or so, re-enchantment, this changing culture of where we see animals, wild animals like the whales or the wolves as kin at one level or another, and we see places as more than just the sum of their parts, as having some kind of intrinsic value, whether it's an aesthetic beauty or whether it's a sense of connection to a larger world or just a sense of mystery that we really don't know what it is, but we sense something. And so enchantment's not just one thing. It implies a range of cultural change where we start to experience the world as more than just objects, dead objects.
You have a chapter in your book on the animal conservation movement, and it's fascinating to see how many well-known activists and naturalists who work with endangered species had a kind of conversion experience, you know, a one-on-one encounter with a wild animal that was life-changing and paradigm-shifting for them.
Yes, it's very common. I think the most famous one concerns Paul Watson's encounter with gray whales.
Paul Watson founded Greenpeace.
They were on one of their early expeditions, and Watson was in a Zodiac out trying to, like, position himself between a gray whale and a Soviet harpoon-firing ship. One whale was killed, the female. The whale's mate, a large bull, then charged the Soviet ship. He got harpooned. And Watson then describes in great detail that as that whale was dying, he made eye contact with it. And that eye contact was a conversion experience for him, that he felt this deep, deep sense of kinship and responsibility. And so subsequently, there was an internal fight in Greenpeace where Watson's actions were seen as too risky and provocative. He left. He founded Sea Shepherd. And Sea Shepherd then began a policy of basically destroying pirate whalers on the high seas and in ports. And they are still out there today trying to protect whales.
So we're talking about a process of resacralization, you know, in which we're coming to see the natural world and the animals who people it as sacred. But what makes something, you know, a place or a creature or an object, what makes something sacred? How does that process work?
Well, there's no simple formula for that. In other words, what sacredness has to do with a contrast to the ordinary. At what point then does an elk become just an elk, and when does it become an animal with a name and a following and a sense of connection to a larger world? There's no set answer. But certainly, we're talking about an intensity of feeling where people, they're broken out of their normal emotional range. Then the intensity of life force, the other creature or place, reaches out to them. We're talking about articulation of these feelings in language. It is part of the process of re-enchantment or consecration or resacralization is the actual expression of it, the sense of which we can articulate our feelings in evocative, poetic language and images.
When you say that people are coming to see nature as enchanted, do you mean that we're coming to see the natural world as magical?
If you take magical in a broad sense, are animals and places, is there something mysterious about them that somehow we're never fully going to comprehend? Is there a sense of that they represent a connection to a larger universe? Yes, I think so. And that is part of their appeal, is the sense people want that sense that they're connected to a larger universe, and certain kinds of wild places and wild animals start to meet that need as an entreeway.
So how do you think this effort to see the land and the entire living cosmos as sacred, how do you think this is changing American culture?
I think that we're making tremendous progress in that it puts limits. If the land is sacred, and using that in a very broad definition, then there are limits to what humans can do to it. Because in some sense, you have to respect the integrity of that land and its creatures. And this sense of putting limits on ourselves, on what we take, and the realization that other kinds of lands and creatures need to survive, that's really important. It should help put a limit to consumerism. It should help increase our ability to form the will to restore degraded places. So I think that it's a profound cultural change. It's still spreading, but there is still a partial disconnect between how far the culture has progressed and what the political leaders are willing to do.
Have all the stories you've collected taught you anything about finding the poetry in your landscape? Because I think I heard you say that part of the process of re-enchantment involves giving a deep enough attention to the land or a creature to find some poetry, something transcendent in it.
I had a much longer record as an environmental activist than shows up in the book. Los Angeles had roughly 1,000 acres left on the entire basin floor that hadn't been developed. It was a old Hughes aircraft site and degraded wetland in Beanfield, north of the LA airport. A developer came in and wanted to build a city there called Playa Vista. I spent about 10 years of my life working as a journalist trying to save that land from development. And as I watched the movement there work and not work, what I saw them doing was to try to re-enchant that degraded place to help people imagine what it might be. Restoration took place. On the very first day as a journalist, when I went out to cover the movement to try to save Bayona, I was on a bluff above the degraded wetland, and the bluff had just been bulldozed in order to build a development there. And as I was walking out to the bluff, a field mouse ran from the bluff down the street up to a driveway and buried its head against a cinder block wall. And I saw that mouse and I realized it had been driven insane, that I was looking at an insane creature that was fleeing for its life. So I've never had a mystical encounter with a bear, but I saw the mouse and I saw the dead snakes in the bulldozer treads on Bayona, and I never forgot them. And I always was sad in that sort of like, so this is the best we can do in L.A.? We only have 1,000 acres left and we're going to kill what's there? So I hold on to those kind of memories.
William James Gibson teaches sociology at California State University, Long Beach. He's the author of A Re-Enchanted World. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him.